Okay, well, first of all, while you are within a jhana, you are perfectly aware. Your mindfulness is very strong. What you are aware of are the various forms of piti sukha. When you enter the jhana, there is no nimitta left. What you are aware of in the first jhana is the piti sukha, which is born of being separated from the five senses and the body, otherwise known as vivekaja piti sukha, from vivichewa kamehi, from the five senses having disappeared. The five senses are a burden, they are a heap of dukkha. When it disappears, you have the happiness, the bliss of it going away. That is the object of the first jhana. The object of the second jhana is when the last bit of chetana disappears. The vitaka vichara, which is the movement of the mind onto the object and holding onto the object, when that vanishes, you are aware of the bliss born of samadhi, of stillness. When the will vanishes, that whole heap of dukkha caused by chetana disappears, and you are happy, the piti sukha born of chetana vanishing. Then part of that piti sukha settles down and disappears. Then you just have the sukha, a different, more refined type of happiness. That is the object of the third jhana. And the fourth jhana, that gross, we call it gross, maybe that's not the right word, but that less refined type of happiness of the third jhana settles down and vanishes, and you have this pure equanimity, which is another form of happiness, upeka sukha. Those are the objects which you experience in the jhanas. And while you are within those jhanas, it does not change. It is a very stable and constant experience, sometimes for many hours. And when you emerge out from that jhana, five hindrances still disappeared, and you can reflect back upon what you have just experienced. In the same way that you know what you had for lunch today, and that was just something ordinary, something powerful like a jhana, leaves a very strong impression on your mind, so that you can remember it incredibly clearly. It's called pachawekananyana, the reflecting or reviewing wisdom, which you look back on that jhana, and then you can understand exactly what you have been experiencing, what type of piti sukha it was, and that will give you an idea of what type of jhana it was. While you're in that jhana, you are perfectly awake. But because it is very still, there is very little sense of the passage of time while you're in one of those jhanas. In other words, you are aware, but while you're in the jhana, you have not got much of an idea of how long you're in, which is one of the reasons why when you come out, sometimes hours have passed. This is not a state of unconsciousness. It's a state of a massive awareness, great power. One of the signs that it was a jhana is when you emerge out of that jhana, the five hindrances are absent, you have immense mental power. You feel an incredibly strong mind, very aware. For example, as I've mentioned this morning, whatever you look at, it's so incredibly beautiful. The grass is greener than you've ever seen before. The sky is more blue, deep blue. simply because your mind has got power after the jhanas, and you still have a huge amount of piti sukha left after you emerge from jhanas, you are very, very happy. So if somebody comes out of what they say is a jhana, they come up to me and said, Ajahn Brahmawangsa, I've just been in jhana. I look at them and say, if you can say it like that, it was not. You're powerful afterwards. Ajahn Brahma, wow, that was an incredible state I've just been in. There is an emotional afterglow. Huge power. That is a sign. So these aren't states where you just are unconscious. These are states where you're fully aware. But they are different than ordinary states of awareness. When you come out afterwards, you know something fantastic has happened. They are uttari manusa dhamma, and they leave great power in your mind afterwards. Those are signs that that was a jhana. And you are able to look back in there and find out what piti sukha it was. What type of bliss, what the object of your mind is. It is this, you can look at it again. And when you look at it again, then you can actually understand what it is. That is what happens within the jhanas. They are powerful states. So don't try and lower the standards. I was meditating, I was happy, and then everything vanished. I came out afterwards, what happened? If you actually say what happened, and you can't find out, it probably was not a jhana. If you say what happened, you'll be able to look back and it's very clear in front of you what it was. And the tradition of doing vipassana afterwards, please bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, please keep looking at the sutras, the teachings of the Buddha. And there you will find there is no thing which says, now you do samatha, now you do vipassana. They always go together. So after you've emerged from jhana, you don't do vipassana. You don't do samatha. This is a natural progression. You've just had a powerful state of mind. Automatically, you know, you will look at that state of mind, reflect upon it, investigate it, find out what it was and find out its meaning. It's not something you do. It's something that happens. Remember what I said this morning. There is no one in there to do anything. You're in a refined state of mind post-jhanas. The very idea of a self or a me, it's either totally gone or very diminished. Basically, you can't do very much. You know the story of the Buddha after his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. Bodhi tree, spent 7 days just staring at the Bodhi tree. When I first read that, I thought, that's impossible. How can you do that? But if you have some idea of how still the mind gets in a jhana, and how afterwards there's hardly a sense of self left, which can do anything, it's quite clear that that probably happened. So still, there's nothing there to do anything. No person to click the mouse on the computer. No person to steer the wheel. It's gone, so nothing happens. Perfectly still for a long time. An example, do you ask if people do get jhanas? They do get jhanas. This one young man meditating just, you know, in our hall in our city center. He got into a jhana, sitting after everybody else had left. And I was very pleased that one of our caretakers waited for him to emerge from the jhana and just led him to a dark room just to somehow come out of that jhana slowly. Because if you come out of a jhana and you have to face this world again, it's like pouring hot water into a cold glass. It can crack the glass. So you have to be very careful. After the jhana, you're very, very sensitive. So, if you have been a Buddhist before, or for a Buddhist, sorry, then you will have heard enough Dhamma. You've heard enough Dhamma, so when you come out of that jhana state, you will look back upon that and you say, my goodness, that was bliss. Why? Bliss is a sign that some suffering has disappeared. You investigate and see these five senses are dukkha. Second jhana, you'll see this will is suffering. Deeper jhanas, this consciousness is dukkha. You can see that. You don't have to do it. Now, do you have to decide to listen to me when I'm speaking so forcefully and so loud? It's just what happens. And that's what happens when you get this powerful experience of the jhanas. Things have vanished. Does the frog have to think, wow, something has happened, water has disappeared? Does it have to decide once it's left, oh, now I must contemplate water? It's such a strong experience, the frog has got no choice. But, wow, something strange has happened. What on earth was that? Water has gone. So, when you emerge after jhana, it becomes obvious. But I must say that sometimes it does seem that only a couple of times, especially in medieval Christianity, a couple of monks did seem to get jhanas. St. John of the Cross, Teresa of Avila, who was recorded as actually levitating. This was a nun, many in the 12th, 13th century. And sometimes I wondered, how could they do that and what did they do afterwards? The reason why they could do that is interesting for you to know. In that tradition, they surrendered themselves to their idea of God. That surrender was their path. It's another way of letting go. They did not do anything. Surrendered the will. Let go. No choice. God take over. And when they got into those jhanas, when they came out afterwards, interestingly, they described that as union with God. That's how they described it, because their wisdom, the way they understood the world, was there was a God, God is powerful. Now imagine, you've just been into a jhana as a Christian. When you come out afterwards, that's the most powerful bliss you've ever experienced. And you have disappeared. And a Christian would interpret that as union with the ultimate, union with God, as do the Hindus. Remember learning from a people who had attended a Hindu retreat, they were trying to get what they called the blue nimitta, the pearl nimitta, and when they merged with that, then that was union with Brahma, and they'd finished whatever they needed to do. Samadhi, the stillness, was their only goal. Now, if any of you achieve such a jhana, then that's what it feels like. You can understand how a Christian misunderstood and thinks that's the end. As a Buddhist, you know, we've all had enough understanding. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. There is no God, no self. That is already inside of you. You have enough wisdom. You don't need that much to see those states and look at it through that perspective. And you will see, instead of, this is incredibly powerful, blissful state, you will see why, because suffering has ended, at least a lot of suffering. You will see, yeah, there's no self there, but this is not God, because other jhanas happen, more of you disappears. If you like, God vanishes in second jhana, third jhana, bye-bye God. And also, you know, you see that things, they do disappear. So as a Buddhist, you have enough understanding, learning, that you will see those jhanas, not as a Christian sees them, and believe their union with God. You will see them in terms of anicca, dukkha, anatta, and then you will get so on. But the point is that this is how you will look at those. Insight will happen naturally. You don't have to make a choice, decide to do something, exercise your will, And in fact, it's incredibly difficult to exercise your will after a jhana. The deeper the jhana, the harder it is to get going again. I like to tell the monks who I've stayed with, I don't know how many years ago, I had the great opportunity to have a holiday as a monk. 6 months I did not need to teach or go anywhere. So I, instead of traveling around the world visiting people, I stayed in my hut and visited other states inside of myself for 6 months. I was meditating, not seeing another human being and not speaking to anybody for 6 months. And when I came out, after 6 months of retreat like that, it was incredibly difficult to think. People would ask me, how were you? Just the mind was so still, it didn't want to think, it couldn't. And I realized I had to tell people how I was and what I had been doing. And no exaggeration, I had a headache for 3 days because I had to force my mind to do things again. And this is just a 6 month retreat. After a jhana, you can't decide, I'm going to do vipassana now, I'm going to teach, I'm going to brush my teeth. The mind is so calm and so cool, it can't make those decisions easily. It happens automatically. Just like even getting into jhana. You don't decide to get into jhana. If you do, you can't make it. Your mind is too rough to say, oh, I'm now going to get into jhana. That is too coarse. You let go and jhana happens. After jhana, you can't do very much. Insight just happens, just like jhana happened. But you do not do it. So for me, the whole idea, yeah, after jhana you do vipassana, that is impossible. If you think you can do that, that is not jhana. It just flows into insight. That is much closer to the reality of how these things happen. When the Buddha emerged from fourth jhana under the Bodhi tree, he did not decide, oh, I might as well get enlightened now. It just happens. That's what occurs. Hopefully that clears that up. Please look at the suttas. Please have some experiences. And this will be very clear to you that this is what happens. You all know the story of Alarika Lama and Uddaka Ramaputta. And that always causes people a lot of discussion. Because if you read that story, it says that the Alarika Lama taught the state of nothingness. Uddaka Ramaputta taught the stage of neither perception nor non-perception. The Buddha was, the Bodhisattva attained what the teacher had attained and realized it was not good enough, not conducive to ending suffering. Now, you must never just look at one passage alone without comparing it to other passages. In other passages, the Buddha said specifically, like in Mahamalukyaputta, Atanagara Sutra, that the state of nothingness, akinchanyayatana, is a basis for the insight of Nibbana. So there is a contradiction there. Either the Buddha said one thing in one place and another thing in another place, or we're missing something. And what one is missing is that those could not have been the real states because they weren't based on jhanas. Basically, if you can experience any of these states, you will see that the fourth jhana is a necessary base for the arupa attainments. You cannot sidestep or detour around the four rupa jhanas to get into the arupa states. You may pretty much say that the four arupas are a special case of the fourth jhana. They're all contained in this fourth jhana attainment. from the fourth jhana, things disappear and you can achieve or experience the arupa attainments. Now, that could not have been the case under Alarakalama and Uttakaramaputta, because number one, the Buddha said these states were not conducive to the arising of insight, of enlightenment. And number two, when the Buddha gave up on those practices, he had to look back upon the time he was a young child under the rose apple tree to remember a jhana. If he had attained jhana under Alarakalama and Uttakaramaputta, he would have remembered the jhanas under those monks. So it is very convincing argument that under Alarakalama and Uttakaramaputta, he never experienced the jhana, which means they weren't the real states. Number two, when the Buddha decided to try jhana as his way towards enlightenment, please know that Majjhima Nikaya 36, Mahasashika Sutra, the Buddha said, oh, that time I was under, or the Bodhisattva, that time I was under the rose apple tree getting first jhana. He said, is that the way to Bodhi, to enlightenment? And the insight came, that is the way to Bodhi, the jhana. That's where the insight came. And then, number two, the Buddha or the Bodhisattva said, it's very difficult to attain those jhanas with such an emaciated, weak body. Which meant from that time, in order to train the jhanas, he started to bathe, eat properly, rest properly. At which point, his five disciples abandoned him, thinking that he'd gone over to luxury, he'd abandoned the path. Now that is also important. If you're too austere ascetic, you can't attain the jhanas. And so the Buddha had to go a different way to get those jhanas. So much so that his friends abandoned him. If he had got those jhanas under Uttakaramaputta Alarakalama, he wouldn't have needed to change his austerity. And his friends would not have abandoned him. It was a different way, the middle way, which he pursued, which is quite comfortable. Did you have a nice lunch today? Delicious. If you were in the time of the Buddha, the five ascetics would have abandoned you. You're eating too well. You should eat just rice and maybe half a bit of curry and that's all. You're too fat. You're sitting on cushions. Sit on the hard floor. Be tough. Because people thought you have to be austere to be able to get to any state of enlightenment. And the Buddha's insight was you have to be have this middle way in order to attain the jhanas, in order to attain enlightenment. So I cannot see how the Buddha could have attained any jhana under Uttakaramaputta and Alarakalama. They didn't do jhanas. So what did they do? What was this state which they were teaching? Even today, you can go, actually, if you want a PhD, all you need to do is to get a Daika to send a check to some universities in the United States and you can get a PhD by return of post without any study. Is that PhD worth anything? It still says PhD, but it's, you know, just you pay money for it. It's not worth anything. Standards go down, 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 down. Even many people argue with me, Ajahn Brahm, your standards for jhana are too high. Other monks, their standards are much lower. And they would get lower, lower, lower to make people, to have more people attain these things. Standards always decline. And I reckon that that's probably what happened with Alarakalama, Uttakaramaputta. Maybe years ago under the time of Kassapa, those were real attainments. Now they were just declining. It is thought of nothingness. Nothingness became your object of mind. You can actually stay with the perception of nothingness, but it was not the arupa state based on the fourth jhana. You can have an idea. Okay, no perception, neither perception nor non-perception. Cultivate that idea until it's really, really strong. Because it's not based on the jhanas, it's a totally different thing. Next argument. In a Chittasangyutta, one of my favorite stories from the sutras, Chitta, the householder, went to see Nigantha Nataputta, the leader of the Jains. And they were discussing about the development of the mind. And Nigantha Nataputta asked Chitta, the well-known disciple of Gautama, the Buddha, he said, "Do you really believe that through meditation you could stop thinking?" And the Chitta said, "No, I don't believe that at all." "See," said Nigantha Nataputta, "even this well-known disciple of the Buddha knows that you cannot stop thinking. It is like putting your fist in the Ganges to stop the current. It cannot be done. And even the disciple of the Buddha says the Buddha is wrong. He doesn't believe it." And then Chitta said, "Yes, I do not believe it because I know it, because I practice jhanas. These disciples of the Buddha are sneaky and very hard to have a conversation with." But what is interesting in that passage is the leader of the Jains at the time, which was probably a much bigger group of followers than the Buddhists themselves, did not even know that you can get into such a state of meditation where all thought stops. He had no idea that jhanas were possible. So, in Hinduism at the time, were there any jhanas? I would say no. That the Buddha discovered jhanas. And that was a translation of Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi in the Panchalika Danda Sutta. I think it's a Devaputta Sanghuta. The Buddha who discovered jhanas. That's in there. It's in twice in the sutras. I've never ever seen, not even once, the Buddha who discovered vipassana. The Buddha discovered jhanas, that's it. So look, what are the five causes for the decline of the sasana in the Kassapa Sanghuta? Do you know the five causes for the decline of the sasana in the Kassapa Sanghuta? Disrespect to the Buddha, disrespect to the Dharma, disrespect to the Sangha, disrespect to the training, disrespect to samadhi, to stillness, to jhanas. And it's because of the disrespect, the lack of importance given to jhanas, that the sasana declines. The sasana declines because of the disrespect to the training, not keeping Patimokkha precepts. You know, just accepting money. There's only money, what the heck? You know, it's what we have to do. We can't do anything else these days. That's disrespect to the training rules. Disrespect to the Sangha. You know, that's happening in the West. You get groups of lay people calling themselves Sangha. People who meditate, they sort of keep precepts and they call themselves, like in Sydney, the Blue Gum Sangha. They're a group of lay people. That is the decline of the sasana. Disrespect to the Sangha. Disrespect to the Dhamma. Disrespect to the Buddha. Those are the five causes for the decline of the sasana. I just focus on the last one. Disrespect to samadhi. Just do vipassana. No need to get jhanas. That's decline of the sasana. You should let go of the unwholesome things first. And then the unwholesome things secondly. And then you'll get into the deep meditations. So you let go of wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood. At least get strong sila first of all. So let go of unwholesome things. Let go of your mobile phones. They're unwholesome. They just disturb you all the time. Let go of most of your possessions. How many robes do you need? How much stuff do you need? Actually, in Sri Lanka it's pretty good. In Thailand it's gross. You know, there was a monk who was in the newspapers. He had his own private jet. And they had a picture of him with his own private jet, and he had, I think, a Louis Vuitton bag. He'd just been shopping somewhere. This is a monk. So, you ask him, please let go of your private jet. That's an unwholesome thing you should let go of. But if you can't let go of those things, what can you let go of? To let go of those things and let go of stuff. Keep it as simple as you possibly can. Okay, and if you're Metta-Vihari, he has to have his mobile phone. He arranges all of this. He couldn't do this without that. So, you know, there are a few exceptions. But if you're a simple monk, you're not doing anything for other people, you don't need that stuff. And let go of wholesome things, keep it simple. And then you let go of the wholesome stuff as well, which is a brilliant, you know, this simile of the raft. You let go of everything to cross over. How much do you need? Let it go as much as you possibly can. I once gave a simile of the hot air balloon. For those of you ever seen a hot air balloon, these big balloons, you put either gas in it or hot air and it rises up above. They've got a basket where the people stand in. You go so high and you can't go any further. How can you go higher? You've got to throw something out. So you look in the basket, what can you throw out? They've got these sacks of sand called ballast. You throw them all out. And you go higher, you can't go any higher. So what can you throw out now? You throw out your lunch. And you go higher, and you can't go any higher. And all there is a basket, there's you and the balloon. Now what can you throw out? You throw out the basket, and you just hang on to the balloon. And then you go so high, but you can't go all the way to Nibbana. So then what you do? You throw yourself off. And then the balloon goes to Nibbana. In that simile, you know, the ballast and the lunch, that's all your sensory desires. Your good, wholesome and unwholesome stuff, the gross parts. Throw that all out. Until all is left is you, the basket and the balloon. The basket represents your body and five senses. You throw that out, and there you are into jhanas, just you and the balloon. Now what can you do to get enlightened? You have to throw your sense of self off. Throw you off the balloon. And then the balloon goes to Nibbana. Let go of wholesome stuff, first of all. Unwholesome stuff, wholesome stuff. Let go of your body. Let go of your mind, your will and your consciousness. Now those are the hard ones to let go of. Especially your will. But eventually you do it. You get brainwashed into doing this. You know in the sutras they say that you cannot even achieve stream winner without the words of an Aryan. Have you ever understood that one? Why you need the words of an Aryan to be able to get to be a stream winner? Because your will cannot do it by itself. You need to be literally brainwashed by an Aryan in order for you to let go. So that's why you have to listen to brilliant teachings. Otherwise it just cannot be done. You need an Ajahn Chah to brainwash you. And he needed his teacher to brainwash him into seeing these different things to trick your will into basically killing itself. That's the only way it can be done. And the Lord Buddha, was he really enlightened by himself? Who taught the Buddha how to become enlightened? And the answer's obvious. Those people who... It's fascinating. You're challenging accepted knowledge in Theravada Buddhism. Gatikara Sutta. I'm sure you've read that. I hope you have anyway. Gatikara Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Gatikara was the chief disciple of Kassapa Buddha. His best friend was Jyotipala. Or Jyotipala. I always get that wrong. Jyotipala. Jyotipala didn't have anything to do with Kassapa the Buddha. He actually called him bad names. Really bad karma to call a Buddha bad names, is it? Because Jyotipala eventually got tricked by his best friend Gatikara to see Kasyapa Buddha. And as soon as he saw Kasyapa Buddha, he got faith, became a bhikkhu, and spent the rest of his life with Kasyapa Buddha as a bhikkhu. And Siddhartha Gautama, our Buddha, said that was him in his previous life, or in a previous life. So Siddhartha Gautama, our Buddha, was a disciple of the previous Buddha. So, under the Bodhi tree, you read the account, gets into the jhanas. What's the next thing the Buddha did? He remembered his previous lives. And if you had a previous life as a disciple of the Buddha, you would remember that. He would remember being a bhikkhu under Kasyapa Buddha. He would remember Kasyapa Buddha teaching him the teachings special to all Buddhas, the Four Noble Truths. So that is where our Buddha would have got his teachings from another Aryan. That was the seed of the Buddha's enlightenment. That is Theravada. It's in the sutras. Look at it. Can you question that? It's there. Kasyapa Buddha was of this eon, not that long ago. And there's another sutra somewhere which says, anyone who's a stream winner, Sotapanna, so on, for the most part gets reborn in the Tusita realm. And we know the Lord Buddha came to this life, our Buddha, from the Tusita realm. Was the Buddha a stream winner when he was born? Was he even further, a once returner? How come, according to the legend, when the Buddha was born and spoke, he said, this is my last life? Maybe because he knew he was a Sakadagami. This was his last life. That's why he could say that. So Sakadagamis, for the most part, are born in the Tusita realm. What do you think? A once returner, you know that when you are born, but you forget that as you grow old. People who remember their past lives as children forget them, on average, when they're 6 or 7 years of age. People who, for example, there's one of our members, I shouldn't say who she is, when she had a son, she's Sri Lankan, her son insisted on eating with chopsticks and said that this was not my real mum. My real mum lives, I think, in Singapore. Their name is Chan. A Sri Lankan kid who was convinced he was Chinese up until a certain age and then becomes Sri Lankan again and eats with, you know, fingers or whatever. But this is what happens. For the first few years, you know, and then it disappears. And then you have to go through the whole stuff all over again. Does a stream winner, once they're born, know they're a stream winner from the previous life? A stream winner from your previous life, who gets reborn, say, in this life, has to re-experience the same insight to see non-self again. They have to. They can't not do that. Basically, they have to achieve the same pala in this life. It's inevitable. They have to keep going on again. But when they're born, they don't remember being a stream winner. Well, maybe when they're born, but when they're 7, 8 years of age, they don't know they're a stream winner. It's not directly mentioned in the sutra. It's not mentioned in the sutra. It's something which is outside of the sutras. But if you use a bit of experience and common sense, it makes sense. What is mentioned in the sutras is Gatikara. Sakadagamis, for the most part, are born in the Tusita realm. It's mentioned in the sutra. Siddhartha Gautama came from the Tusita realm. It's mentioned that he walked 7 steps. This is my last life. Ah, yes, certain defilements. As a stream winner, you have only the wrong view has been abandoned. But does that mean when you're a child that you don't have any personality view? You were a stream winner before, but are you a stream winner when you were a kid? Do you know the Four Noble Truths when you go to school as a 5 or 6 year old? It's a very interesting question. But I would say, even though this is not mentioned in the sutras, that if you're going to school, growing up, you're a good kid. You're inclined towards the Dhamma. And sometimes you'll have to re-experience the same understanding of non-self which made you a stream winner in your previous life. It has to be re-experienced. That is what I say. I cannot prove that from the sutras, but it's an interesting question. But the main point I went into this discussion is, how did the Lord Buddha get the seed to actually to change his way of looking at things? You need the paratagosa, the words of another. In other sutras, that's you need to have the words of an Aryan. How did the Buddha become enlightened? Was he an exception? Or did he too need the words of an Aryan? This is why the Christians could not take that jhana and turn it into enlightenment. They thought it was union with God. The Buddhas, you have words of Aryans. Unheard in this life. Never seen before in this life. It was like he said he discovered the ancient city. And the path to that ancient city was grown over. It was there before, but had been forgotten. That is the role of the Buddhas. To uncover a path which has always been there. A city of Nibbana, which is always there, but sometimes gets lost. Anyway, that's by the way. I'm just doing that to make it interesting. Well, this is the way I'll get into an argument and we're missing the point of, in order to get that enlightenment, get the jhanas, get the words of another, and those two together come together, and that's where so one and other things can happen. You know that story which the Buddha said about those two people who went to a village looking for, you know, an abandoned village, looking for some wealth. And one person found a bunch, they both found a bunch of hemp. You know, they all bundled up the hemp, they went along and then they found some hemp thread, then they found some flax, then they found some cotton, eventually found some silver and then some gold. And the guy who had the hemp said, "Oh, this is good enough for me. It's already bundled up. I've been carrying this a long way. Why should I change?" And when they got back home, the one had this bunch of hemp on his head and the other one had a big bag of gold. And the guy with the hemp, he was very stupid. If you see something better, change it. Doesn't matter how long you've been carrying a wrong view. If you see a better view, please throw away the wrong view. But how many people cannot throw away a wrong view just for the reason they've been carrying it for a long time? So that's a really beautiful simile of the Buddha. Sukha vipassaka, dry insight, that is nowhere to be found in the sutras. You are very fortunate these days that when I would look in the sutras, I had to take a dictionary and go through page after page after page. Now all the sutras have electronic versions. You can just type in Sukha Vipassaka and find out where it is in the sutras or Vinaya, and you find no mention. Please remember, do you remember the simile of the Samsapa leaves, where the Buddha picked up some leaves and said, "Which are more, the leaves in my hand or the leaves on the trees in this big forest?" And the people said, "Obviously the leaves in the forest are far greater than the leaves which I have in my hand." "Yes, monks, the things which I know compared to the things which I've taught you are just like the leaves in the whole forest compared to the leaves in my hand. I've taught you so little compared to what I know. But the reason I haven't told you all that other stuff is because it has nothing to do with the attainment of Nibbana. It is unnecessary, useless. You don't need it." And I love that little simile because it says what he's taught you is what you need to become enlightened. Nothing else. The Buddha never kept a closed fist. What is necessary, what is needed is what he said. So if he never mentions sukha vipassaka, it's nothing to do with enlightenment. It's not needed, it's not necessary. It's not there. Can you get enlightened without jhanas? And it's many, many times it says, no, you cannot. The most clear is in Majjhima 64, where it says, just even to be an anagami, a non-returner, you have to have jhanas. Even trying to find to get to the heartwood of a tree without going through the bark and sapwoods, you can't do that. You have to go through the bark and sapwood to get to the heartwood of a tree. In the same way, the Buddha said, you have to go to jhanas to overcome the five lower fetters. No other way. So, I mean, that was so clear. There's no such thing as sukha vipassaka. You have to get jhanas to become enlightened. As I tell the lay people, the lay community, the Buddha was wise and compassionate. Jhanas sometimes are difficult to do. They're worthwhile doing. So if they weren't necessary, wouldn't our Buddha have taught a sevenfold path to make it easier for people? But he always taught an eightfold path. It's necessary. And I mention that simile especially to people in the West, because they just like a fivefold path. Samawata, Samakamanto, Samasankhapa, they don't like that. They want to just break all their precepts, do whatever they like, but still meditate and become enlightened. You should go to the United States and see what some Buddhists get up to. They love meditating, and after they finish meditating, they go to the pub. After the retreat, they go and have sex with one of the nice girls on the meditation retreat. And they think that that's perhaps a non-attachment. The nicest description is a simile of the well. Remember, that's in the Sangyutta, the Nidana Sangyutta. I forget the name of the monks. Sarvita was one of them. Who said that, we understand that there's the five khandhas are not a self. Not me, not mine, not a self. And they said, you must be arahant. He said, no, I'm not an arahant. I'm a soul one. Well, how can you know that there is no self and not be an arahant? He said, it's just like a person going on a journey and they see a well, there's water in the bottom, they can see the water in the bottom, they haven't got a bucket or a rope to pull it up. That's like a soul one. You know, no doubt at all, that there is no self anywhere in here. The consciousness, the will, all the five khandhas are not a self, not me, not mine, not a self. You've seen that totally 100%. You know it's anicca, dukkha, anatta. But you haven't reached the water yet. First of all comes the knowledge of the Dhamma. One of the nicest ways of explaining that is through the Buddha's description of the vipalasas. Now the vipalasas of ditti vipalasa, sanya vipalasa, and it's in citta vipalasa, yeah. And citta in the sense of thinking. Thought. So if you have wrong view, a jitta vipalasa, you'll perceive according to that wrong view. If you believe in Jesus, you will see Jesus everywhere. Ask any Christian. The evidence is obvious. If you believe in it, that's what you will see. And once you perceive it, you think accordingly. And once you think accordingly, that supports your beliefs. This is a cycle of cognitive distortion. If you start in your view, then you perceive according to their view. The view, what you don't want, what doesn't fit your beliefs, you can't even see. A good idea about that is sex. Is sex happiness or is it suffering? People experience it as pleasure. Because they're taught it's pleasure. But if you ask any psychologist, when a person has sex, the part of their brain which turns on is the same part which turns on with pain. It's a fascinating piece of research, but it's the pain part of the brain is what lights up when people have sexual intercourse. But it actually is experienced as pleasure. It isn't pleasure, it's actually painful. But because you have this very strong belief in our society that sexual intercourse is pleasure, that changes our perceptions and people perceive it as pleasure. Which is one of the reasons why the Buddha told Ananda that the sexual pleasure, the Kama Sukha, is a perversion of perception. It's not actually true. You try and tell people that, they don't believe it, because it goes against their views. That's how strong a view can. It can bend the way you look at things. If you hate someone, you can never see anything good of them at all. There's plenty of good there, but you cannot perceive it. Your view allows certain perceptions in, and it stops other perceptions. And your perceptions are the ground of your thinking. As you perceive, so you think. He's a nice monk. I perceive him as a nice monk, and then I think of him as a nice monk. Is he a nice monk? And because I think of him as a nice monk, that reinforces my view. Yes, he is a nice monk. You get someone who's really irritated you, even hurt you, and you think of your idea they're a bad person. You perceive them as a bad person. Because you perceive them as a bad person, you think of them as a bad person. Because you think of them as a bad person, you view them as a bad person. These three things support one another. There is a self. That's your view. If that is your view, you will actually perceive things as a self. You will perceive your consciousness, no, the real consciousness, the thing which is listening to me. You will perceive will to be a self. It's obvious. So you think, because that's how the perception gets distorted. Because you perceive like that, you think like that. Because you think like that, that reinforces your views. So those little three actually is how so many people have so many different views, so many different religions. You ask a Muslim, they are absolutely convinced that theirs is the best religion. How can they do that? They start off with the view, and from their view they perceive it. It's obvious to them. They think like that, and that reinforces their views. So is Buddhism the best religion, or is that a cognitive distortion as well? But you perceive in a sense of self. Now when you become a stream winner, a soul one, what is changed is ditti. You become ditti sampanno. You know, you've achieved right view. You've actually seen this water in the bottom of the well. That's the first thing which changes. Ditti becomes purified. But still, you often perceive things because of your old views. The new views haven't become strong enough yet to change your perceptions, to change your thoughts. Similarly, a person who smokes cigarettes. They've been smoking for so many years, and suddenly they realize, cigarettes are killing me. But they can't give it up yet. They've seen the truth, but it takes a while for that truth to actually stop their habits. Perceptions, wrong perceptions, are bad habits. Just like Ananda was a soul one. He knew that there's no being in here. There's no self, there is no Buddha, there's just a bunch of five khandhas. But when the Buddha was about to die, the Ananda started crying. And he said at that time, the Dhamma had disappeared from me. He couldn't see the Dhamma. He basically forgot it. And his old habits just came to the fore. That's the soul one. You know there's no one in here, but sometimes you think there is. Sometimes you perceive there is. And little by little, those old perceptions based on old wrong views get replaced by good perceptions and good thoughts. Until you come to like Kaimaka, who was an anagami, who said, I'm an anagami, I know that the five khandhas are not a me, not a mine, not a self. But it's just like, you know, you've just washed the robes and there's still the smell of the detergent in your robes. Even though, you know, the detergent, you finish washing, there's still the residue there. The residue of your old wrong views. Still, he said, sometimes I think I am. It's only a matter of time before that residue just vanishes away. And for Kaimaka, it was while he was giving that discourse. The last residue of I am. The last thought. Perception was pretty good. The thought disappeared. And he became another arahat. That's the difference. So one has to come first. And then once the right view is established, then it tends to change all your perceptions gradually into being right perception and then gradually to right thought. So that's usually how the passage from Sowan to Arahat occurs. Know the piti, this piti sukha you get from jhana, are based on the abandonment of the five senses. They disappear. That's the piti sukha of the first jhana. The piti sukha of the second jhana is based on stillness, not on insight, not on seeing things, but on things actually vanishing. It's not on views, it's on occurrences. And obviously the piti of the third jhana just, you know, disappears. Only sukha. So those pitis of the first and second jhana are based on a certain vanishing of something, not on some sort of vision or some view. You do get sort of pity. When you see a Dhamma, you say, oh, yeah, I understand that now. And that gives you a boost of energy. But that's very different. Piti sukha of jhanas, yes. A different cause, and therefore a different flavor. Doing metta to oneself is, if it really is with wisdom as well, then you can forgive yourself and you can let it go. The ahosikamma, which is usually referred to the stream winner, who once they become a stream winner, their past bad karma, which could give rebirth into lower realms, is totally abolished. You cannot get rebirth into the lower realms once you're a stream winner. And I often thought, why? It's not said in the sutras, but the thing with the stream winner, you see there's no sense of self left at all. So that thing in the past becomes very easy to forgive, because when you have a strong sense of self, a lot of time it is built up by what you were, what you did in the past. I would say if I had a sense of self that I was a physicist, because that's what I did in university. I would say I was English, because that's where I was born. Have you ever known that when you describe yourself, you're describing yourself of what you did, where you came from? You describe yourself from the past? When you develop a sense of non-self, that means the whole past, who you thought you were, what you did, tends to vanish. You forgive, you let go, not just of the bad things you did in the past, but also the good things you did in the past as well. Basically, they're not important anymore. So the stream winner can forgive the past because they can let go of the past, which means the past vanishes for them. It doesn't make them reborn in lower realms. But you don't need to do that. You don't need to be a stream winner to do that. Any human being can forgive the past, can let it go. This is in psychology. I tell many people they've done many bad things. You can totally let it go. It's like you've been carrying a big burden on the back of what you've done in the past. You don't have to keep punishing yourself for that. And if you do get when you do get reborn, who sends you into those lower realms anyway? According to traditional Buddhism, there's supposed to be this god, Yama, sends you to the lower realms and judges you. You did this, and you did that, and you have to suffer because this is what you did. Sometimes you wonder, how would a god, a high being, send anyone to the hell realm to suffer? If I was a god and had any degree of wisdom and compassion, I saw anyone do something bad, I'd say, oh, never mind, I forgive you. You're a god, you're a high being. You could not send someone to be tortured for eons. That never made sense to me, how any god could send a being to a lower realm. And of course, that's not actually what happens. What happens is you send yourself to that lower realm. That yama, like mara, is just a reflection of your attitude to punish yourself. It's you send yourself to a hell, and you make that hell according to what you believe you should suffer, and you stay there for as long as you think you need to. No one sends you to hell other than yourself, and no one can free you from hell other than yourself. The gates of hell are always open. You can walk out any time. But so many people don't think they want to. They need to be punished more. Weird. You know, I have a disciple in Perth. Good meditator. But when I asked him, when you die, where do you want to get reborn? He said, I want to get reborn as a dog. I said, what do you want to get reborn as a dog for? He said, well, if you get reborn as a human being, you have to go to school, you have to go to work. And that's really sort of, you know, I don't like going to work. Dogs, they just lay around all day. They lay around all day, they get fed really nice food, they get taken for walks and exercise. Being a dog in a Western country is really a good rebirth. Imagine, you don't do anything, you just lay around, sleep all day, sort of eat really nice food and just get patted and taken for walks. Wouldn't that be a wonderful life? And that was his argument until I told him that if you become a dog in the West, that after a couple of months you get taken to the vet to get desexed. And he said, okay, I don't want to become a dog now. Sometimes people want to become animals, want to become dogs, because they're crazy. So be careful. Do you decide where you're going to get reborn, or does someone decide it for you? If you have wisdom and forgiveness, you never need to get reborn in a lower realm. If you read how the Buddha became enlightened, it was through the practice of jhanas. If you read what he said afterwards, how to become enlightened, he said eightfold path. If you read what is the eighth factor of the eightfold path, sammasamadhi is always, every time, without exception, explained as first jhana, second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. If you read the sutras rather than following your teachers, and don't follow me, follow the teacher, follow the sutras, you will see it so obvious and so clear. Every time Samma Samadhi is first, second, third, fourth jhana. The only way to enlightenment is the Eightfold Path. Ezo wa mago nati anyo dasanasa visuddhiya. That's in the Magga Wagga of the Dhammapada. Ezo wa Magga. This the only path. Nati Anya. There is no other. That's as clear as you can make it. Dasanasa Visuddhiya. For the purity of insight, wisdom if you like. And that is the Eightfold Path. If you look at the sutras again and again, Eightfold Path for this, Eightfold Path for that. So the way to enlightenment is not vipassana, it's not samatha, it's not jhana. The way to enlightenment is eightfold path. Not one factor, eightfold path. Jhana is number eight. Sammaditti sankappa, which I keep on emphasizing on this retreat, sammasankappa. Vajjakamanto ajivo. Your precepts are important. Vayamasati, those are important too. But you can't take any one of those factors and think that's all you need and discard the others. Eightfold Path. Ezo wa mago nati anyo. Dasanasa visuddhiya. Don't follow a teacher. Follow the Buddha. Otherwise, you'd always get confused. The sutras are very clear. Follow them. A good one is Bahiya. Bahiya went to see the Buddha and was just given the instructions. Please listen carefully now. In the seen, there is just the seen. In the heard, there is just the heard. In the sensed, smelt, tasted, touched, there is just that. In the known, there will be just be the known. As a result of that, Bahia became an arahat. Did you become an arahat? You heard the same teaching which the Buddha gave to Bahia. Why did he become an arahat and not you? The reason is because that was just the last little piece which made Bahia an arahat. Remember, he was one of those, how many monks? 5 monks in the time of seven monks in the time of Kashyapa, who climbed the mountain, threw down the ladder, and say, we're going to meditate or die here. He was one of the ones who died, didn't become enlightened. But in this last life, Bahia, you know, he was shipwrecked, and he could hear Devas, one of his friends in the previous life, Anangami, telling him, you're not enlightened, but this fellow Buddha, not far away, actually a long way away, go and see him. And he went there in one night. That's psychic powers. So Bahia had huge parameters, you might say, from a previous life. And his very good chance he had jhanas to be able to do that psychic power of traveling from the west coast of India all the way to the Ganges Valley to see the Buddha in one night. So it's very likely he had jhanas. Because that teaching, but first of all, the teaching to Bahia was also, the same teaching was given to Malunkyaputta. And that teaching to Malunkyaputta, the scene is just the scene. Malunkyaputta was a subject of the Malunkyaputta Sutta, where the Buddha said specifically, you need jhanas to become an anagami. He received the same teaching, became attained. But as far as stream winner is concerned, Visakha at 7 years of age became a stream winner. Now what does that actually mean when they say people became a stream winner in the time of the Buddha? Now it's very weird, even more than Visakha, in the Vinaya, in the first Parajik, in the story of Devadatta, when Devadatta tried to murder the Buddha, now he sent these assassins. He sent one assassin to kill the Buddha, two to kill that one assassin, four to kill the two, eight to kill the four, and 16 to kill the eight. And every time that first assassin came to see the Buddha, could not kill the Buddha gave him a Dhamma discourse, and that person became a Sowan. This was not even a person who's keeping precepts, who came with the intention to murder a Buddha and walked away a stream winner. How on earth can that be possible? That must have been a very low fellow. The same with the two, the four, the eight, and the 16, they all became Sowans. How on earth can that happen? Now I remember when I was studying the Vinaya, that especially in the commentaries, they had this very strange idea with Parajika. If you set a trap in the forest to kill somebody, then if that death is going to be certain, then as soon as you set the trap, you have committed the Parajika, even though no one has died yet. To me, that was very strange. That's in Samantapasadika. I said, how can you have committed a Parajika when there's no dead body? It's because the death is certain. The cause is done now. The death is certain in the future. Therefore, right now, the cause, the action, you've done Parajika now. Even though, you know, the death hasn't occurred yet. That really changed my perception of just cause and effect in the time of the Buddha. We even have a similar phenomenon now when, say, some gang member of the mafia or the Chinese triads, they look at you, Metta Vihari, you have broken the code. You're a dead man. They call you, you're dead. But I say, I'm alive, I'm walking. But it means your death is certain. You're going to die soon. You are dead. It means when something is certain, they call it, you're dead now. Now please remember, if you enter the path to being a stream winner, your attainment of stream winner of the Pala is certain in this life. Once you enter the path, the fruit is certain. And this is only just my interpretation. I cannot prove that, but I ask any scholars to take this further. When they say someone is a stream winner in Nepali, sometimes they do not make a distinction between the Magga and the Pala, because the Pala will certainly happen later on. I would say that those assassins, they would enter the stream. Sorry, they would be stream. They'd be enter the path to stream winners, but they wouldn't get the fruit yet. Visakha would have been entered the path, but not gained the fruit. There would be Sadanusaris. Not Dhammanusaris, they wouldn't have enough time to really understand the Dhamma yet. Sadanusaris, on the path. But the Pali would call them stream winners. They would make no distinction. Contemplate that, because that's the only way I can make sense of a 7-year-old girl being called a stream winner. Sadanusari, yes, certainly. But having the wisdom and understanding there's no self as a 7-year-old, I cannot see that. 7-year-old arahats, but they were incredibly powerful people. Previous lives, people like Dabba Malaputta. That's a totally different character than Visakha. Visakha was very wonderful, but you know, she did have a lot of attachments to her children and other things. But those were powerful little beings who, at 7 years of age, could still remember previous lives. Dabba Malaputta was also one of those people on top of the mountain, you know, with Bahia, if I'm correct. He was one of the ones who went up to the top of the mountain and threw the ladder away. You know, don't believe me. Go and check in the sutras. I can say these things based on the sutras, but based on my own practice. But if you haven't got that practice, how can you believe me? There are so many teachers who say different things. How on earth can you understand which one to believe? I will now tell you how. This is one of the similes which I developed to overcome doubt, based on an experience I had as a young man. When I was a student, I would spend many vacations in Scotland, in the mountains. And one day, I was with the warden of a youth hostel, and we went to walk up to the top of a mountain. It was a beautiful, sunny, warm summer's day. When I got to the top of the mountain, there was another mountain, maybe an hour's walk away. I suggested, let's go to that mountain too. The warden said, no, I've had enough, I'm going back. And I was told much later that you never walk in the mountains on your own. That is dangerous. And it almost killed me. Because by the time I got up to the second mountain, the weather changed so quickly. Clouds came in. The clouds came descended, and I was covered in mist. I could not see more than my hand in front of me, only just. And I thought I had a sense of direction. I decided to retrace my steps to go down the mountain, but I was actually going round in circles. And as I was walking, lost, I came to a precipice about this far in front of me. It was a vertical cliff going hundreds of meters down. One more step and I would have died. And, you know, I was very lucky not to have taken that step. And that scared me. Later on, I looked in the map. That cliff was in 100% the opposite direction I was walking in. And so I was scared. Now, how long am I going to be in this mist? Because sometimes they're there for days. And then I just had a very simple idea. Find a stream. Because water always flows downhill. Find the stream and follow it. And that will take me down, 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 down. Until I get underneath the mist. So that's what I did. I found a stream, followed it further and further down. And it got low enough, I was under the clouds, and I could see my directions and find my way back to the hostel. Now that is similar to how to deal with doubt. So many teachers teaching you so many different things. How do you know which way to go? Find the stream of Dhamma. Whatever it is which leads to more peace, more mindfulness, more happiness, more sense of freedom. What's going downhill, going towards the Dhamma, follow that. If you're following a practice, a way of meditation or a philosophy which makes you more angry, more tense, which unwholesome qualities increase, that cannot be the right path. When wholesome qualities increase, like peace, like mindfulness, like wisdom, be careful of wisdom, because wisdom sometimes is just ideas and thoughts and views. Especially peace, stillness. If those qualities are increasing, you're going in the right direction. Going downhill until you've got underneath the mist, which is so one, and you can actually see where you are. You know which way to go. Until you're a stream winner, you're in the mist, you don't know which way to go, you just have to get the advice of others. You don't know which one is a soul, an Aryan, and which one isn't. A bit of advice, if they say they're an Aryan, they certainly are not. Don't follow what people say. There's too many people I know who think they're Aryans, who certainly not. So be careful there. Go down under the mist, and then you'll become an soul. Then you'll be able to understand which is the way to go. But in the meantime, if you're not an Aryan, find out what the practice makes you more peaceful, deepen your meditation, make you more happy, make your precepts stronger, which make wholesome qualities grow. Follow that. Similarly as being lost in the mist. Follow the stream, which always goes downhill. Okay? Basically, a person who enters the stream is a stream winner, knows what Nibbana is. Knows, this is one of the definitions you see in the sutras. They know the five khandhas will cease without remainder. They know that Nibbana is bhava nirodha, the cessation of existence, with nothing remaining. If a person feels there is something remaining, even a tiny bit somewhere, they should remember the Buddha said it's like having a bit of feces on your finger. Even a tiny bit of feces stinks. Even a tiny bit of existence is suffering. So Nibbana is bhava nirodha. Nibbana is bhava nirodha. The cessation of all existence. Okay, the one who enters the stream, enters the path, hasn't got the fruit yet. They have, you know, the two types of stream, you know, the sadhanusari, dhammanusari. But there's no such thing as pure sadhanusari or pure dhammanusari. You may have 90% faith and 10%, you know, understanding of the Dhamma. Or 90% understanding and 10% faith. And whatever is the most is what you call yourself, sadhanusari or dhammanusari. But if it's sadhanusari, you have in so much faith in what the Buddha said, that you would follow his teachings without question. There was a story, this is from the Mahayana, but it shows you what sadhanusari actually is. There was a teacher, and he never wanted any disciples, and this guy said, "I will be your disciple." And the teacher said, "No, having disciples is a waste of time. You never do what we tell you." And I know that as a teacher is true. And he said, "I will do everything you teach me." He said, "Okay, I'll give you a test." And he said, "That direction, walk and don't stop until I tell you." And so he started walking in this direction. And first of all, he had to go over the paddy fields. Now, if you cross paddy fields, you usually go along the dikes. But he couldn't do that. He had to go in a straight direction. He went straight over the paddy fields, through the mud, up over the dikes, in a straight direction. And then he came to some bushes, some prickly bushes. Instead of going round it, he was told to go straight through it, in a straight direction, to keep his teacher's command. And he did that. Got scratched, hurt, but carried on going straight. Then he came to the lake, and he had to keep going. straight until the water came to his neck. Straight until the water came over his mouth. He had to breathe through his nose. Straight until the water came over his nose so he couldn't breathe. And he was still walking. And before the water came over his ears, the teacher said, "Stop, you can come back now, you have faith." Now that is a sign of faith. If you had that degree of faith, that what the Buddha said, you would follow that no matter if it scratched you, if you got your feet muddy, if it almost killed you. If you had that degree of faith, you'd be a sadhana sari. Have you got that degree of faith? No way. So that's a sadhana sari. That degree of powerful faith. Most people, they haven't got that much faith, but they've got a bit of understanding of the Buddha's teachings. Dhamma nisari. They know, especially they follow the Eightfold Path, they know it works. If you commit yourself to follow the Eightfold Path, all eight factors, not missing one, samavacca, you're going to make your speech perfect. Kamanto, you know, your actions. And all the other factors as well. If you are going to follow that and you understand why it should be done, the Eightfold Path leads to only one place. And that's the experience of Nibbana, stream-winning and everything else. Keep it precise and simple. Don't try and find a shortcut, just mindfulness. Don't try and find a shortcut, just jhanas. Don't find a shortcut. Please cultivate all eight factors of the Eightfold Path. So simple. But everyone else just makes it so complicated. They try and make shortcuts. I told people in BMRCH yesterday, a few years ago, actually, I don't mind telling who they were, the Wetty Mooney family. They took me to Kandy to give a talk, and they drove me back from Kandy to Colombo. And they decided halfway, at the bottom of the hill, to do a shortcut. We ended up just a little bit north of Kalutara. Everyone else had got back. And they were, "Where's Ajahn Brahma, the driver, gone?" We're about 4 hours later than everybody else. Because they took a shortcut. If you take a shortcut on the path of Nibbana, you will never get there. Eightfold Path. The straight road from Kandy to Colombo. Do the straight road. It's the fastest. You may think there's lots of traffic, but it's quicker than any other road. But we all think we know the shortcut to avoid the traffic. But we end up wasting a lot of time. But I thank them for getting me lost, because that gave me a story to tell other people. If it's real faith, faith is very dangerous. But you don't know who you can have faith in. And there are so many people who say that they are right, who say that what they know is true and everything else is false. How do you know who you're going to put faith in? Even if some of your teachers have psychic powers. So did Devadatta. He had psychic powers. And it was not a good thing to put faith in him. They may be a great teacher. Now, Adolf Hitler was a great speaker. He had people spellbound for hours. Thousands of people would listen to his talks. But don't just follow a teacher because they've got lots of disciples, because they give really brilliant talks. Or because, you know, that other people say they're enlightened. Be really careful. So, how can, as well as the miss simile, also look, we do have a reference for Buddhism, the sutras. And this is a piece of advice, you know, which I got from Jnanaponika, Venerable Jnanaponika, many long years ago. He was having this discussion with Jnanaramita and Bhikkhu Bodhi in the forest hermitage up in Kandy. And I remember him telling me, never interpret the teachings of the Buddha in light of one or two ambiguous passages in the sutras. Instead, interpret the ambiguous passages in the sutras in light of the vast mass of clear, precise, often repeated teachings in the sutras. So you have such a vast teaching in the Buddha Sutras, and those are repeated many times. Those are the ones you can trust, and the passages which can be taken many different ways. Interpret them in light of the ordinary vast mass of teachings in the sutras, and then you won't go far wrong. Unshakable, that means you're a stream winner. You're so what? Yeah. Unshakable confidence, Avaita Prasada, is one of the descriptions of someone who's attained to the path of stream winning. I would also, to stir everybody up, if you don't know this already, don't follow the Abhidhamma. It was not taught by the Buddha. This is the evidence. Have a look at the evidence. Don't just believe because you are told. Number one, if you look at where they talk about the first council, there, what happened at the first council? Look in the Vinayapitaka. It's there quite clearly. There, first of all, the Arahat Upali recited the Vinaya. And then the new Arahat Ananda recited the Pancha Nikaya. What are the Pancha Nikaya? The five Nikayas. Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, Kudaka Nikaya. Where is the Abhidhamma? In the Kudaka Nikaya. Is that just miscellaneous? Kudaka, just know the bits and pieces. Is the Abhidhamma that unimportant? Then why would it be put in the Kudaka? No, you don't. Not in the Pali. Have a look. That's what it says. Pancha Nikaya. Number two. Look at the language of the Abhidhamma. Example, I have to use the English language. If you look at Shakespeare and compare it to Harry Potter, the language is very different. The way that words are used, the type of vocabulary. And scholars can work out by the language, the words, when something is written. Harry Potter is a very, very new sort of type of English. Shakespeare is, was it 400 years old? The language is different. Scholars look at the Abhidhamma and they know, but the language used, the grammar, the way it's put together, it is much older, a couple of hundred years after the time of the Buddha. There's only one place in the sutras where Abhidhamma is mentioned. It's a Gulisani Sutra. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya somewhere. And that is the sutra of the qualities and things expected of the Aranyavasi, the forest monk. And there the Buddha said, a forest monk should be an expert, no more than the village monks, of Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. What was a forest monk doing, knowing more about the Abhidhamma than the village monks, who were the ones who had all the books? Because in the time of the Buddha, Abhivinaya, what could that mean? Because it was mentioned in the same verse as Abhidhamma. Abhivinaya, Abhidhamma. The Abhivinaya of a forest monk was the greater restraint, like the vinaya of the Dutangas, the vinaya of simplicity, the vinaya of greater restraint. That was what Abhivinaya meant, not a separate set of books. And the Abhidhamma, the forest monk would understand more about the Dhamma because of the power of their meditation. Their penetration of things like Four Noble Truths, Eightfold Paths, would be greater because their forest monks were the ones practicing. And it doesn't make any sense that the Abhidhamma in the sutras meant a group of books. And anyway, What is one of the Abhidhamma books, Katawatu, points of controversy? Was it Moggallputtisastra and was he the king at the time? Yeah. Sorry? No, it wasn't Ashoka. It was, no, the points of controversy, no. Yeah, it was that Milinda. No. That's right, yes, always with Ashoka, yeah. That was at least a couple of hundred years after the time of the Buddha. And so sometimes in the commentaries they say, well, you know, it was spoken, actually done 200 years, but they knew beforehand it would be spoken, so they were just predicting it. That makes no sense at all. The Buddha actually said, to question, don't believe. Don't just take it on what you're taught. But Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi. Trouble is, many people are afraid to question. You're told Abhidhamma was taught by the Buddha, you just believe it. Question it. Have a look at the evidence. If the evidence says otherwise, you have to follow the evidence rather than tradition. Otherwise, Buddhism will stagnate. The main point is, just don't believe. Look at evidence and find out for yourself. And the evidence is very compelling. The one thing which we can trust is just the vast number of teachings in the sutras. That is consistent. Again and again and again. So that's what you can trust as the teachings of the Buddha. So that should be our standard. Okay. And you have to be strong in protecting the Dhamma. And don't just go according to tradition. Please find this out for yourself. Do the research. Look at the evidence. So a lot of other really intelligent people, good people, have actually made those studies. Look at what they've said. And the evidence is very compelling. Make your own choice. If you want to believe that the Abhidhamma was spoken by the Buddha, you have my respect, that freedom to make your own choice. But if you don't want to, you have my greater respect, because I agree with you even more. Okay, let's part for tea. Thank you.